You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us today. Now, how cool would it be to have a lightsaber? One Wisconsin teenager thought it would be super cool, so he built one himself and it works. Coming up, we're going to meet him and tell you about the National Engineering Award he received as for the project. Now, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services announced this week that booster shots of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines will become available for all adults next month. The agency expressed concern that the most vulnerable people, the elderly and those with underlying health conditions, may see decreased immunity in the near future. Across the country, COVID cases are on the rise and vaccination rates have slowed significantly. In Wisconsin, the seven-day average of cases has been on the rise since July. According to the Department of Health Services, the seven-day average for new COVID cases is around 1,224 per day. And we are talking about the pandemic and where we're at now and what the future could bring. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the COVID booster shot? If you're an older person or someone with an underlying health condition, what questions do you have? And how are you feeling about where we are so far in the pandemic? Call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Jonathan Tempty is with us. He's an associate dean for public health and community engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's an expert in vaccines and immunization policy. Dr. Tempty, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much, JC. It's a pleasure to join you. I wish I didn't have to at this point in time. We were hoping that we were going to be seeing something different.
And I think that's kind of what many of us expected to see, but putting everything on the table, COVID cases are on the rise in the United States. Many states, including Florida, Louisiana, and Hawaii, have broken records for new cases this week. Take a temperature. How is the country doing as a whole right now?
Well, so far, over 37 million of us have had COVID, and unfortunately, we've seen 623,000 deaths across the country. And so this is an enormous public health and a personal health crisis out here. We haven't seen anything like this in our lifetimes. But as you mentioned earlier, we have seen not only Wisconsin, but across the country, a steady increase of cases starting in early July. And we're now at a level that we have not seen since last January. So the arrival of the Delta virus, I think, changed virtually everything.
Now, talk a little bit about this news that a booster shot is very likely going to be on the horizon, of course, for more vulnerable populations first, our senior citizens and people who might have underlying health conditions. Can you talk about where we are with this booster shot?
Yes, certainly. This is a really interesting case for those of us involved with policy and making vaccine recommendations. It appears as though the policy is almost already there. We're seeing today news releases saying that they anticipate beginning in the third week of September, September 20th, that all Americans will be eligible for a booster dose. That, however, doesn't take into account what has to happen before we get there. And the first thing that really is needed is an emergency use authorization, again, from the FDA to look at the science behind the booster dose and whether or not, number one, there appears to be a need. Number two, that the use of a booster or an extra dose is beneficial. And probably most important, that the booster dose in general is very, very safe. And once that happens with a emergency use authorization, then it basically gets lateraled over to the CDC and the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, whose job it is to independently review the evidence and make a recommendation that is then approved by the CDC director and the Secretary of Health and Human Services. So before those steps happen, you really can't have at least what we would call a legitimate recommendation out there.
Now, Dr. Tempty, I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Samantha in Whitehall. Hi, Samantha.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I'm just wondering, why are we worried about giving people a second dose in the first place, or talking about, second, like a booster in the first place, when there are people out there that we're trying in a loving way to convince to get the shot? I know some people that just won't, one that's scared to get it, and there's a couple that are married that just won't go get the shot at all. They're not going to. And how do we help those people before we worry about giving a booster shot to anybody? That's what I'm wondering. Why don't we just try to help those people first and then, a booster shot?
Samantha, thank you so much for that call. Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Tempty.
Yes, Samantha, I think you asked the most important question of this entire session today. And it really pertains that a booster dose is going to help that individual, but it's not going to do very much for us in terms of bringing this whole pandemic under control. And that's why we need to reach out and get vaccine into all those people who have not received vaccine. For example, in Wisconsin, we've had about 53-54% of our residents receive at least one dose, and about half of us have had the complete series. But that means that there are 27 million Wisconsinites who have not received any vaccine as of yet. And this is the pool that will keep this pandemic, this outbreak going. And 27 million people is a lot. And I have to say that most of that group have not had COVID as of yet. So these are all people who are susceptible and can come down with this, can transmit to other people, and will likely, or much more likely than those vaccinated, end up in the hospital or in our intensive care units. So that's a really important question as to how to get the vaccine out. And unfortunately, we've seen those rates steadily decline. We're at the point now, we really have to work very, very strongly with our primary care physicians, our nurse practitioners, our physician assistants, just to use those trusted relationships with patients to try and break through that barrier.
We are talking to Dr. Jonathan Tempty right now, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Now, one of the maybe troubling things that we have definitely seen and heard is what some lawmakers are calling the pandemic of the unvaccinated. And it goes along with Samantha's question, which is, why aren't we focusing on them first? But these vaccines aren't really new. What kind of challenges still are public health officials facing to convince people to get vaccinated at this point?
Well, I think there are two basic themes out there. Number one, that the pandemic isn't all that serious. And there are still people who really think this is no more than a bad year of influenza. And influenza is the virus I've studied most over my career. And I can assure people this is far, far worse than any influenza we have ever seen, at least in our lifetimes. But then the second part is really the fear and the concerns over safety of these vaccines and the perception that these were rushed into utilization. And all I can say at this point in time is that with the incredible uptake of vaccines in this country and across the world, there's been 4.5 billion doses of coronavirus or SARS virus vaccine, COVID-19 vaccine, administered across the world. And compared to other vaccines, we haven't seen any increased safety problems as compared to those vaccines that we are normally administering to children, to our older adults, and to everybody on an annual basis, for example, with influenza. So these have had a very good track record in terms of safety. But I also have to say that in the initial emergency use authorization, the usual bars were hit in terms of the safety assessments. These trials just got off the ground really, really quickly, and there were a lot of participants that allowed us to assess the safety quite quickly. Now when we're talking about licensure, this requires the safety assessments to go out a full 6 months after the last person received vaccine, and we're just about there. So we're going to see the licensure of both Pfizer and Moderna in the next few days or weeks.
We are talking to Dr. Jonathan Tempty right now, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And he's talking with us about the latest COVID news, including that recent news that a booster shot could be on the horizon. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the vaccines, whether they be the Moderna, Pfizer, or Johnson & Johnson? Did you get vaccinated? What did you think about the process? We want to hear from you. Call in now, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we'll continue this conversation in just a moment right here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we continue our conversation with Dr. Jonathan Tempty, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And we are talking about COVID, COVID booster shots, and more, and want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. And I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Louie in Oconto. Hi, Louie.
Hi. I have one comment and then a question. But my comment is this. I'm glad some organizations like Summerfest and things like that are requiring either be tested or vaccinated before you go on the grounds. And I think it's time that we stop coddling some of these people. And it's like, if you want to do fun stuff, that's fine. If you don't get your shot. But now here's my question, though. We know that this vaccine replicates, and we have variants when it replicates. What about the breakthrough infections when you have the vaccine, but you're asymptomatic or you come down with milder symptoms? Are we still replicating that virus?
Louis, thank you for that question. Dr. Tempty.
Yeah, so when we get infected, the virus basically hijacks the mechanisms in our body's cells to make copies of themselves. And they do so very effectively and efficiently, and they make basically billions of copies. And it's the attack of the cells, and as they leave the cells, they tend to destroy the cell as well. This causes a lot of the damage and the disease we see. But you are absolutely correct that people can have replication of this virus without having symptoms. So unfortunately, with COVID-19, we run the gamut from people who are totally asymptomatic to people who are deathly ill or even die from the disease. The people who are the most sick probably have the lowest likelihood of transmission, and the people who are minimally sick can tend to transmit. And this is where we get into some challenges with vaccines, because they're so good at preventing the negative consequences of illness that when we do have a breakthrough case, oftentimes those people who are vaccinated with a breakthrough case are asymptomatic and are able to transmit. And some recent work done here at University of Wisconsin by some of my colleagues have shown that the amount of virus in the secretions of the people who are vaccinated and asymptomatic are basically about the same as people who are symptomatic. And so that's really kind of worrisome here. The good news is by being vaccinated, you're far, far less likely to become infected in the first place, whether it be symptomatic or asymptomatic. So we still want to make sure that people are vaccinated. But just by being vaccinated doesn't assure us of being able not to transmit. It's still possible. So we still have recommendations out there right now in Dane County starting tomorrow with masking for everybody indoors. And that's because of just the insidious nature of this Delta variant.
Now, Dr. Tempty, we're now in this situation where people are still getting sick. And, you know, in the early days of the pandemic, we saw a big groundswell in getting tested. The National Guard was testing a lot of people. Do you see going back to that, where we have these mass testing sites to continue to track the Delta variant and potentially other variants as they emerge?
Well, I think absolutely yes. If we look across some of the states that have been really hit hard, we see on news reports the mass testing sites coming back up again. If we look in, for example, Dane County, where I'm based, and simply going on to the Madison Dane County Public Health website, one can see the testing locations that are available. The big difference right now is many of those locations have been changed over to pharmacies where they have the people, the tests, and so on available there. But so I think right now it's a wait and see across Wisconsin whether or not we get into the very large mass testing. But the testing is such an important part of the public health control of this virus. If you know you have it, you can take actions to prevent other people from getting it.
We're talking to Dr. Jonathan Tempty right now, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And I want to go back to our callers right now. We have Kenny in Wausau. Hi, Kenny.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. What did you want to bring up, Kenny?
Okay, the last man on there, and I got a lot of what he covered answered a lot of my question. But if the people that are vaccinated have such a low cause of, with, like, say they can transfer the variant, but it's such a low thing where it affects them, why are they needing a booster now?
Kenny, thank you so much for that call. Again, a question about the necessity of a booster shot.
Well, I think it's really important, Kenny, that we talk about who is getting vaccinated out there. And if the only people that we had in our population were young, healthy people in their 20s and 30s, we might not be having this conversation. But at any one moment across the United States, there are 7 million of us who are immunocompromised because of cancer or medications we're taking, things like that. And we know that many of the breakthrough cases are in people who are immunocompromised. So, for example, right now we know that 40% of breakthrough cases occur in those 3% of the population who are immunocompromised. We also know that with older people, their immune systems are not working as well. So once we get into long-term care facilities, nursing homes, and those situations, individuals will tend to not have as good a response to the vaccine initially, and the protection will tend to decline more rapidly over time. And so we have to look at the whole composite of people. And then finally, the people who were vaccinated early on, for example, in December and January, now we're looking at being out about 7 to 8 months after that last vaccine dose was received. And all vaccines tend to decline or wane over time. So I think we have all these things happening in concert. And in particular, I'm mostly concerned about those people who are immunocompromised, those people who are elderly, whose immune system may not have responded very well to the first two doses. And I think those people really need to be prioritized for any booster. And then we have to start looking at the people who have been vaccinated a long time ago. But so we really have a mixed population out there of people who have differential response to the vaccine and have differential immunity.
Dr. Tempty, I want to go back to our callers, and a thank you to Kenny for that question. I want to go to Joanne in Madison right now. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. I would like to know, I am fully vaccinated, and I'll be 65, and I had a suspicion that I might have been asymptomatic maybe a week or a week and a half ago. And first off, I tried to get a testing, and it was almost impossible to get it, like, immediately. But anyway, I'm wondering if now would I, if I could get tested for antibodies, and then if that would show, if I had antibodies, does that mean that I actually had COVID and I was asymptomatic?
Joanne, thank you for that call. Dr. Tempty, we have about a minute left. Can you talk about the antibody tests and what we can learn from them?
Yeah, that's always a challenging question because there are a lot of different antibody tests out there, and there unfortunately is no good standardization, and there can be both false positive and false negative tests. So at the end of the day, most of us don't know how to interpret those results. And so I don't know if there's much benefit in that. However, even if you're vaccinated and you think that you may have had a breakthrough case, be it asymptomatic, I think as we go on, there will probably be guidance out there to receive a booster dose. And we just have to wait and see what the recommendation is showing out.
And Dr. Tempty, in the last 10 seconds we have, what will you be watching for next?
Well, my biggest concern is the collision of the Delta virus, the coming of the autumn, waning immunity, and schools coming back into session with transmission amongst school-age children. Those are the big players right now.
Dr. Tempty, thank you so much for joining us today and answering all of our questions.
And thank you so much for having me. Take care now and keep safe.
Dr. Jonathan Tempty is the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us to talk about the latest COVID news, including that booster that is on the horizon. This is Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. Now, Star Wars fans admit it. You'd kind of like to have your own lightsaber, wouldn't you? You have that light-up energy sword that can cut and burn and melt through stuff with almost no resistance. Plus, it makes a really cool sound. There is no mistaking that sound. And our next guest is into Star Wars and one day finally said, enough is enough. I need one of these in my life. So he went and he built one, an actual working lightsaber. And guess what? He's only in high school and he just won a really impressive national award for his lightsaber. Cabrin Walker is about to begin his senior year at Madison Country Day School. He was a national gold honor winner for his lightsaber project at the NAACP's Act So student competition last month. Cabrin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So how cool is it that you have a lightsaber?
It is insanely cool. As a Star Wars fan, I've dreamed about it since I was a kid. And it doesn't make the cool sound. It doesn't make that infamous whooshing sound. But it does make a cool flame sound that sounds kind of like a flamethrower.
So you have this lightsaber, and not many people would say, hey, I'm going to go and I'm going to build one of these things. Can you describe the moment when you said, hey, I'm going to go for it?
I can. I was watching Return of the Jedi.
Awesome.
I can't remember why I was watching it. I just, one day I woke up and I was like, I really want to watch this movie. And it wasn't until it was the scene where Luke had started to slice and dice all of the guys on Jabba's like floating palace over the Sarlacc pit that I realized, like, I want to do that in real life. I'm going to make one. And that was about a year and a half ago. So it's been a journey, that's for sure.
Okay, so many people have seen that scene and they don't go out and they don't make a lightsaber, but you did. Can you talk us through about how to make one?
So first you need to find an ancient Jedi temple. No, I'm just kidding. I am just kidding. So the first thing I did is I researched if it had been done before. And in fact, it had. It had been done by three different people, and they each took three different approaches to it. There was Alan Pan from Sufficiently Advanced. These are all YouTube channels that you can look up. And then there was Alex Lab, and then there was the Hacksmith. And Alex Lab and the Hacksmith mainly dealt with plasma, which I'm not qualified to deal with at all. However, Alan Pan took a more chemically engineering approach where he used a mixture of acetone and methanol to basically make it so that the fuel is ignited and then evaporated in that three-foot span to make the blade. And that's the one that I decided was not only the simplest, and yes, it was expensive. However, my main goal was to make it cost less and still have the desired outcome.
Cabron Walker is with us. He's a rising senior at Madison Country Day School. He's a National Gold Honor winner for his lightsaber project at the NAACP's Act So student competition, walking us through how we can make our own lightsabers. And Cabron, I'm pretty sure that ancient Jedi temple is probably on the western side of Wisconsin. So if you want to go check it out, you might look there. Now, you took this to this competition. Can you talk about what it was like being there?
It was surreal because I never thought that I would be amongst these amazing other competitors who genuinely had amazing projects. You know, they were working with VR, cameras, sensory technology. And here I am, I made a lightsaber. And because I had worked on my project for a year and a half, everything felt really simple to me. However, it came off really complex to other people. And I feel that kind of gave me a little confidence boost because I'm like, man, I feel like an actual Jedi. You know, you describe the Force to somebody and they're like, that's impossible. And the Jedi are just like, yeah, well, we do it every day. So it was definitely surreal. And I didn't even expect to enter into the competition. This lightsaber was kind of something I made just because I thought it would be fun. And then the opportunity presented itself and I said, why not? And that's how we got here.
Now, you described that it doesn't make the wooing, whooshing sound that many people are aware of. You said it sounds a little bit more like a flamethrower, but what does it look like when it's on?
It looks like a very thin flamethrower. I did a lot of research into what makes a flamethrower, and there's liquid flamethrowers in which they ignite the liquid, and then there's actual powder flamethrowers in which they ignite powder. And I didn't want a powder flamethrower because it's really hard to regulate the stream and all of that. However, I used somewhat of a design that I took from Alan Pan and from flamethrowers where you just ignite the fuel, and then it gives like this really, if you've ever taken hand sanitizer and lit hand sanitizer on fire before, or taken, you know, lighter fluid and lit lighter fluid, it's really, there's the surface of what you're igniting, and then there's the flame that comes up. And it looks like that. It looks like whichever the force neutral of gravity is, wherever you're pointing that, which is usually up towards the sky, is where the actual flame comes off of.
So this was a pretty big undertaking for you, even though in the end you said it feels like it was more simple, but then you ended up winning. So this feels like a first step in engineering in many ways, much more complex than I ever did at your age. Do you see yourself continuing down this path, maybe making a hover car or something at some point?
That would be amazing. However, this is kind of more like a side thing for me. Yes, it's very a very complex side thing. But the main thing that I want to do is I want to go into art and design, and possibly maybe double major in engineering. But it's mainly just kind of seeing how I'm feeling in this last senior year. And if I really want to continue with this, then it's definitely something that I can do. I am definitely looking forward to making more projects.
Well, Cabron, this has been a lot of fun as a Star Wars fan and as a science fan. It's been super fun to talk to you today.
It's been fun being here. Thank you.
Kay Bryn Walker is a rising senior at Madison Country Day School. We talked with him about the lightsaber he designed and built for the NAACP's ACTSO student competition. He won a gold honor for his work. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about reimagining archaeological digs on tribal lands.
Frog Bay Tribal National Park sits on the shores of Lake Superior. It's on the land of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, also known as the Anishinaabe. Frog Bay is the first tribal national park in the country, and for the last several summers, it's been home to a collaborative archaeological project between tribal leaders and university archaeologists. The goal is not just to find new artifacts, but imagine a new way for everyone to work together. A new podcast from our partners at Wisconsin Humanities called Human Powered has the story. Here's host Jimmy Gutierrez.
For the last 3 years, the Red Cliff Tribal Historic Preservation Office has been collaborating with two archaeologists helping excavate sites on tribal lands. During these digs, students, researchers, and tribal community members work together to learn about the people who have lived on this land for millennia and to connect that knowledge with the people who still live here today, which for so long hasn't been the case of archaeological work.
Indian people has been studied to death. You know, study after study after study after study.
Marvin Defoe is the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for Red Cliff, otherwise known as the TIPO.
They say, well, this is how they used to be. That's what they used to do. So that word they disconnects everybody in our whole community. We're here today. We're alive today. We ain't going nowhere. We're alive today, but there's a story on how we came to be.
The TIPO office is in charge of a lot of things. Things like the annual powwow, the language school, and making sure that none of the sacred sites get disturbed. So sometimes Marvin gets calls from archaeologists. Archaeologists like Heather Walder. Heather works at UW-La Crosse and the Chicago Field Museum.
I remember calling Marvin just cold to speak with the TIPO to talk about this project.
You know, when Heather gave me a call in Red Cliff, do you know of any place in Red Cliff that maybe we could kind of take a look at, whatever, and I started thinking. I said, yeah, we go out Frog Bay.
The dig started at Frog Bay Tribal National Park in the summer of 2018. Asking tribal members for input is crucial as the group makes sense of what they find in the ground. For example, take the bunches and bunches of cracked rocks that were being found all over the site. Marvin had an idea.
Heat them up, put them in a container. I call that a Anishinaabe microwave oven, you know.
Marvin's Anishinaabe microwave came from a story he heard from an indigenous elder in Canada. That elder took his grandkids out for the weekend to share traditions. And one morning, they caught a fish and started a fire.
You know, so he took the fish, heated up them rocks, and had to drop, and he put that fish in there, and he put a little wild rice in there, and put them rocks in there, put the top on, wrapped it all up, and propped it in the bow of his canoe.
A few hours later, they had a delicious lunch cooked with hot rocks inside of a cedar log. Top Chef has nothing on this. Today, Marvin shared that meal with us. The same meal an elder shared with his grandkids just a few years ago. A meal that was shared with the people at Frog Bay who lived here 5,000 years ago.
We all have a job to do today. We all have a job to undo what happened to us as indigenous people. If you teach a child to love the land, that child will protect it. And part of how you love the land is you gotta understand yourself and love yourself as a native person. And it ain't just doing the archaeological thing, it's you live it. Zitchigewin, you live it.
That story came to us from Human Powered, a new podcast from Love Wisconsin and Wisconsin Humanities. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we will compare and contrast what's happening in Kabul with the 1975 fall of Saigon. That's coming up next, right here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. The Biden administration is working to tamp down comparisons of what's happening in Kabul, Afghanistan, to the 1975 fall of Saigon, South Vietnam. Over the weekend, images of helicopters evacuating American staffers from the Kabul embassy surfaced as the Taliban took over the city. Here's what House Minority Whip Steve Scalise had to say about it on CBS's Meet the Press.
In fact, you just had President Biden a few days ago saying you wouldn't see helicopters evacuating the embassy like Saigon. And yet here we are. This is President Biden's Saigon moment. And unfortunately, it was very predictable.
The Biden administration is rejecting that analogy, but our next guest says the two events are strikingly similar and that they teach the same lesson. Michael Allen is an associate professor of history at Northwestern University. He's also the author of Until the Last Man Comes Home, POWs, MIAs, and the Unending Vietnam War. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today on Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So why do you say that Kabul and Saigon are so similar?
Well, I think that most viewers, particularly those who lived through the evacuation of Saigon in 1975, will note that the images are similar. And that's what Steve Scalise was referencing there, the images of people madly sort of rushing for the exits and clinging to aircraft. All of that's very reminiscent. But I think the more substantive comparison really has to do with the nature of both of these conflicts. In both cases, you had a 20-year U.S. commitment to try to build a Western-style democracy that was defended by a U.S.-equipped and U.S.-modeled modern military. And in both cases, that very elongated, decades-long effort ultimately failed and failed with sudden and surprising quickness at the end. And I think that, you know, that deeper comparison is really the one that Americans need to focus on. And it calls into question the efficacy of using American force to try to build a nation from the outside. I think we've seen both in Afghanistan and before that in Vietnam, that that's a very difficult prospect.
Now, there were, 25 years in between what we saw in Saigon and, you know, the United States getting into Afghanistan after September 11th. You know, could we possibly see, as sort of that memory fades, going back, not into Afghanistan, but maybe getting into one of these excursions again?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think that one of the things that, Afghanistan teaches us is that we tend to have rather short memories about our own history and about the limits of our power at times. That in both cases, there was a reference to World War II and the occupation of Germany and Japan. And this was not just true in Vietnam, where Germany and Japan were cited as examples of how the United States could participate and succeed in nation building. But it was also true after 9/11, when many likened 9/11 to Pearl Harbor. And the idea was is that we would go in and sort of set the world right as we had done in World War II. And certainly the U.S. does have some instances of succeeding in that in its past, but it also has more recent examples of failure. And I think we tend to remember our successes and quickly forget our failures. I could get into what accounts for the differences between one case and the other, but I think it boils down to the fact that in Germany and Japan, you had modern industrialized states with modern militaries that were being tinkered with rather than trying to create these institutions from sort of whole cloth.
We're talking to Michael Allen right now, Associate Professor of History at Northwestern University, about the comparison between the fall of Saigon and what we have seen in Kabul. Now, there have been some people that have referred to Kabul's fall this week as Saigon on steroids. Would you go that far to describe it that way?
No, not really. I do think that the fall of Kabul and the overall kind of capture of provincial capitals throughout Afghanistan was very sudden. But I would remind listeners that that was the experience in Vietnam as well. Most of South Vietnam collapsed within the single month of April 1975. There were a few northern provinces that had collapsed before that. But given the scale of the U.S. commitment, particularly the scale of U.S. arms that had been shipped to South Vietnam for years prior to April 1975, that struck everyone as incredibly and shockingly sudden, in much the same way that the fall of Kabul looks to us today. And, you know, in terms of the numbers of folks trying to get out, to evacuate, I would say that if anything, the Vietnamese case had larger numbers. You know, there were roughly 6,000 Vietnamese evacuated in the final days, but there were over 100,000 Vietnamese evacuated from South Vietnam in April 1975. So the scale was just as enormous, and the suffering and sort of human tragedy was very comparable. So I don't see this as a more accelerated or more shocking event than Vietnam. I simply think that it's kind of doubly sad that this is happening again, when, as we've talked about, you know, I think we had reasons to think that maybe we could avoid these kinds of things based on our prior experiences in Vietnam.
Now, just a moment ago, we heard from House Minority Whip Steve Scalise. I want to turn to Secretary of State Antony Blinken. He was on ABC's This Week, and he said that what we saw in Kabul was manifestly not Saigon. That is a quote. Let's hear the rest of what he had to say.
We've been in Afghanistan for 20 years, $1 trillion, 2,300 American lives lost. And again, thankfully, having succeeded in doing what we set out to do in the first place, the president made the determination that it was time to end this war for the United States, to get out of the middle of a civil war in Afghanistan, and to make sure that we were looking at our interests across the world, around the world, and that we were set up to advance those interests.
So, you know, President Biden said that we completed our objective, which was, you know, making sure that Al-Qaeda didn't gain a bigger foothold in Afghanistan, and then it was time to go. Is that similar to what we saw in Vietnam?
Well, I think what we're hearing there is something that critics of the Vietnam War would often sort of suggest as a solution to the Vietnam War, which was to simply declare victory and go home. Regardless of whether or not victory had actually been achieved. I mean, I do think that the Biden administration is correct that the sort of immediate objectives that justified the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 were met long ago, you know, at least with the death of Osama bin Laden. You know, the problem with that is that a whole another set of objectives emerged well before the death of Osama bin Laden in the Bush administration that had to do with, as I talked about earlier, building up a different sort of Afghan nation with a different government and a different military. And that's really been the mission for, you know, decades now. I would say it's really since the early 2000s. And that mission clearly has not been achieved. And I would say probably can't be achieved.
So, Michael, we really only have about a minute left. You know, looking at the lessons from Vietnam, looking at Afghanistan, what will you be looking for next?
Well, I'll be very curious to see the degree to which Americans who decry the scenes in Kabul show their commitment to resettling, not just the folks at the Kabul airport, but the millions of Afghan refugees who've been displaced in this war and who have been waiting for a long time to try to exit that war-torn country. Last I looked, there were over 2 million Afghan refugees even before these events, and it's really important that they be assisted in being resettled. elsewhere in the world, as has been the case after Vietnam. So I'll be looking to see if that happens, and I hope people that are concerned about this situation will recognize that we have a responsibility to help those who've been displaced by this war.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Michael Allen is an associate professor of history at Northwestern University. He also wrote the book Until the Last Man Comes Home, POWs, MIAs, and the Unending Vietnam War. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.